You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Good morning. I'm Karen Dynan, Vice President and Co-Director of the Economic Studies Program at Brookings. I'm pleased to introduce our keynote speaker for today, Bank of America President and CEO Brian Moynihan. Brian has been CEO of one of the world's largest financial institutions since 2010. Bank of America serves many different audiences, consumers, businesses of all sizes, as well as institutional investors, with a full range of banking, investing, asset management, and other financial and risk management products and services. If you are thinking that you see them everywhere, you are correct. They bank one out of every two American households. I've gotten to know Brian through my work on Bank of America's National Community Advisory Council. The council is a group of consumer advocates, community development promoters, and wonky types like me who offer thoughts to the bank on how it can best help underserved Americans. Brian grew up in a small town in Ohio, the sixth of nine children. In high school, he had a job as a busboy, dug ditches for sewer projects, and worked after school at a plant that made industrial magnets. He later attended Brown University. That's actually something we have in common, where he played rugby quite well, according to my rugby-playing friends, and he met his future wife. Brian took a somewhat atypical path to the top of the banking world. He's a lawyer by trade with a law degree from Notre Dame. He started out in the general counsel's office at Fleet Financial in 1993, which then merged with Bank of America in 2004 and was eventually elevated to general counsel in 2008. When Bank of America bought Merrill Lynch as it was teetering on the edge of bankruptcy during the recent financial crisis, Brian was named CEO of the investment firm and then CEO of the bank. So Brian became CEO at what I think we all would agree was a tumultuous time in the banking industry. Under his leadership, the bank has focused on reducing non-core assets and businesses, as well as its mortgage servicing portfolio. Fortune magazine wrote of Brian, "A close look at his career reveals that he's proven his mettle for two decades as a deal maker, team builder, and crisis manager. And he is perhaps uniquely suited for the job of chief executive in today's banking world. The business is now so complicated and so fraught with hidden dangers lodged in such esoteric products that the best leaders are those who are totally immersed in the data and details, the ones who serve as their own risk managers." That's Moynihan. So Brian's going to speak, and after that, he'll take questions, and then we'll have a panel discussion featuring several prominent housing experts. So with that, please join me in welcoming Brian Moynihan.
Thank you, Karen. As Karen said, she is a member of our National Community Advisory Council, which other members of the panel are too, and we really appreciate the work they give us, the insight they give us, and the advice they give us. I'm grateful to be here with the Brookings team for putting together this important forum. As you think about things, there's a saying that says, confidence never comes from knowing all the answers, but being open to all the questions. And I think that's where we are with Housing United States, is to think not about the answers, but really to focus on the questions. Forums like today are designed to challenge our thinking, to tackle those questions, and to raise those questions so we can get the answers. Questions about the impacts of the recession and population growth, the future prospects of that in home ownership. Questions about lending standards and how those will ensure home ownership is accessible and, most importantly, sustainable for borrowers. Questions about the role a strong affordable rental program will play in the future of housing for our people, and questions about the proper role of the government and the private sector and the balance between those and our financing system. By focusing on these questions, we can build confidence in the housing system going forward. You obviously have a distinguished panel that you'll see later to discuss these questions, and I invite all of you to keep pushing this dialogue forward to make sure that we continue to replicate this conversation not only today, but in the coming months to ensure we reach the right outcomes. It's a dialogue the Bank of America is committed to be a part of, and one we're looking forward to having gotten through one of the tough periods of time in the country's housing history. Begin this dialogue, I want to make a few observations today about where we are in the housing recovery, and I'll talk about some other issues. Now, there's an incredible amount of work that has been done over the past few years to help homeowners in distress. In the last year, we and our colleagues in the industry have made great progress. We've implemented the programs that the government has sponsored, including the mortgage servicing settlement. You've now seen greater stability in home prices around the country, but obviously there's work to do. While there are still areas of the country that are hurting more than others, the housing market is showing signs of real, sustained recovery. Overall, home prices are up. Housing demand is up, which means more construction, which is a good thing for the overall economic recovery and for jobs. The delinquencies in the portfolios continue to decline across the industry. The national servicing standards are in place, and the alternatives to foreclosure have been in full swing for many months and quarters. Our company acquired Countrywide at the height of the housing crisis and inherited a severely distressed portfolio. As a result, we've done a lot of work to help and assist homeowners. To date, we've helped nearly 1.5 million, that's 1.5 million people, avoid foreclosure through modifications, short sales, and other programs. Today, our company has 50,000-plus people working on this, 50,000 people working with these borrowers every day. Now, to put that in perspective, only a quarter of the Fortune 500 companies have a total of 50,000 employees, and we have them dedicated to this task. The industry has put tremendous resources working to help customers get the right solution. Modification programs offer payment relief, short sales, and relocation systems, in some cases up to $30,000. And we have principal reduction programs that are in full swing now, cutting principal on average about $150,000. These programs continue to make a difference for the customers that can be helped. But even with a strong arsenal of programs and generous principal forgiveness, redefault rates, while better, are still high in these programs. Why? Why is that true? Because at this point in the cycle, it isn't the lack of the programs, it's other issues causing it. Many customers still are fighting unemployment or underemployment or become unemployed or have an unpredictable employment posture going forward. They still feel the impacts of the recession and lack the cash flow to sustain the payments, even a modified one. So important to the housing recovery is letting the process continue to move forward to help customers get the right solution, even if that means transitioning to rental. To give you a sense for that, in 40% of all the foreclosure sales that we have today, the property is actually vacant. So we also must become more efficient how we move those homes back into the system. To do that, we work with cities like Chicago on an initiative to fast-track vacant properties through the foreclosure process so that we can get them useful again. Getting vacant properties back on the market as fast as possible makes a big difference in our communities and cities and to the neighbors who don't want to see abandoned homes in our street. What is true today has been true throughout this. When a home is actually taken possession by us, we sell it within 60, 90 days. We've also partnered with cities like Detroit and others on programs that donate and rehabilitate vacant properties. We just announced this week a partnership with Habitat for Humanity, a partnership that will donate 2,000 vacant properties, a partnership that will provide those properties, rehab those properties, to people in need of an affordable home. We've also committed to donating over 1,000 properties with a specific focus on returning military. So far this year, we completed about 150 donations to military families. Families like U.S. Army Specialist Nicholas Salerno, his fiancée and two children, who recently received one of our donated homes in Tampa. Specialist Salerno suffered serious injuries in his last tour of duty in Afghanistan. He and his fiancée have credited their new home with providing a fresh start that their family needed. So as we think about housing and the future of housing, how does everything we've learned during the crisis and recovery apply? It underscores the need to shape a system that keeps borrowers out of the situation of owning a home and not being able to afford it. It means shifting the conversation from what percentage of Americans own homes to what is the right solution at the right time for every individual customer. As the housing market strengthens, now is the time to have this dialogue in earnest so that we can reset to a more secure, more sustainable system for all the players involved. What I'd like to do is frame the rest of remarks around the main participants in our housing system, homeowners and home buyers, lenders, and the government. I want to discuss some of the assumptions we need to challenge and discuss the questions we need to ask in terms of what a reset might look like. So let's talk about the reset. For homeowners, what are the resets we have to make around home ownership? What is remarkable is given everything that people have been through in the past several years, that survey after survey continue to show that the overwhelming majority of Americans still aspire to home ownership. Most Americans still rank homeownership as an important part of their view of the American dream. But as you look deeper in those surveys, you'll see that much of the value that an American places on owning a home is emotional, not financial. Take, for example, the most recent Fannie Mae housing survey. The top two reasons for home ownership were to have a good place to raise children and a safe place to live. As a just democratic society, we all are citizens, a safe, good place to live. But a roof over one's head doesn't always have to come with a mortgage. In some cases, it shouldn't come with that. Home ownership is valuable. There's not a question. It stabilizes a community and leads to more civic engagement and investment. Those things have been proven over time. For those who purchase a home for a place to live and make long-term payments, a home can also provide a vehicle for wealth creation. It's important to recognize that much of the value created during the housing bubble in the mid-2000s was more the result of expanding credit and over-borrowing and over-lending than it was from underlying home value appreciation on the fundamentals. So think about it. Historically, the long-term average of home appreciation going back to 1975 is 4.6%, and that includes the recent bubble and burst years. Since 2001, the average appreciation has been all 2%. So leading up to the crisis, the virtues of homeownership, stability, security, and savings got disconnected in the 2000s from the act of homeownership. The laudable goals of an ownership society evolved from building long-term equity to cashing in on short-term gains. In many cases, it became less about a safe place to live and more about making profits. Home purchases for investment gains and not for shelter increased from a historical average of about 4% to 28% in 2006. Homeowners heavily leveraged in their home became the norm. Cash-out refinances, using the money for other things other than improving the home or developing the home, completely disconnected the positive aspects of owning a home from its value. According to Freddie Mac report, for eight consecutive quarters at the height of the crisis in 2005, or height of the buildup in 2005, the cash-out refinances exceeded 80% of all the refinancing. So a question we need to consider and policymakers consider is that if people are going to take cash out of a home or speculate in a home and buy for investment or buy multiple properties to rent as an investment, should they be able to do so with mortgage capital, especially mortgage capital is guaranteed by the government? We need to look hard at some of these old assumptions and ask the question if homeownership is the right solution for everyone. Is there more value and more flexible housing options? We also have to challenge the assumption of stability versus mobility and other factors that affect us, two-income households, changes in family structure, all the things that have become a part of our modern society. Workforce mobility and flexibility is increasingly important to people in America to counter potential income shocks, locational decisions about where to work, and this is the case in the last recession, has been the case up until today. According to some of Karen's research that she's found, the volatility of household income rose nearly 30% in the past four decades. In addition to these realities, the past 5 years of high unemployment and underwater home values have taught us that sometimes flexibility for workers and people to move and not be burdened by a mortgage is a virtue. A 30-year mortgage contract does not provide flexibility in some cases. So we have to challenge the assumptions about the flexibility and mobility of the American people relative to housing and mortgage finance. We also have to challenge the assumptions about the purchase cycle. It's important to understand that the purchase cycle, the cycle of which you buy homes, has fundamentally changed. Macro conditions were working in favor of a robust housing market. The economy was strong. Population growth was high. Demand continued to high. House prices continued to rise. A lot of that isn't so true anymore. The world looks at the United States, and the United States looks at itself with a fundamentally lower projection of growth. If we were sitting in this room in 2003, the forecasters would have expected a growth rate of 3.1% in GDP for the next 6 years ahead, and a long-term average over sustained decades ahead of 3.3%. In 2012, those forecasts were sitting here today. They would say they expect 2.5% growth for the next 6 years and a long-run average of 2.7%. Along with lower expected growth, unemployment is more uncertain, and long-term unemployment has risen to record levels. Today, 40% of unemployed workers are employed for longer than 6 months. That duration is historical levels. The historical average is 13%. That, again, affects people's stability at times of unemployment and their ability to make their mortgage payments. There's also the issue of what is the probability of unemployment. Is it higher now than it used to be? I think the statistic would prove that true. U.S. household formation has also slowed dramatically. Average annual household growth for the past 5 years has been about a half million a year, less than half the pace in the first half of the 2000s. And if you look regionally, and housing is always local, the demographic issues we just described are much different by different areas of countries. In a city like Detroit, there's lost substantial population in the past decade, according to the census. A debate about home ownership is much different than a city like Dallas, where population growth has maintained its strength. So all these factors taken together, weaker economic growth, slower household formation, employment certainty, duration of unemployment uncertainty, all make the purchase cycle, or should make the purchase cycle, slower. And it'll make it harder for a borrower to find an escape valve if they end up in a mortgage that becomes unaffordable for any issues at any time. Another thing we have to challenge, the assumptions about risk. Ultimately, we believe a more sustainable housing model rests on more than just prudent lending standards, but also on our ability to educate America about the inherent risks that come with the responsibility of home ownership. At Bank of America, we continue to focus on homebuyer education and partner with a network of more than 600 nonprofits to provide purchase counseling in connection with mortgages. Coming out of the crisis, credit repair will also be a prime focus, and we're working with counselors and educators on steps consumers can take to repair their credit and prepare for sustainable ownership going forward. So absolutely, home ownership is important. The American dream is important. But we need to think about and understand the real attributes of home ownership as we look for it, and we have to understand the risks. Because even a responsible home buying decision carries some risk. I get letters every day from our customers. Customers are struggling to pay their mortgage. And if you want to read those letters, they tear your heart out. It's letters from people who can't pay their mortgages for the same reasons they couldn't a decade ago, two decades, or three decades ago when I started in this business. They've gotten sick. They've gotten divorced. They've lost their job. They've lost their income levels. That uncertainty and those things are not going to change as we look forward. So as we think about these questions from the homeowner side, these are the kinds of issues that we need to reset. So how do we support the positive aspects of homeownership? How do we help make smart financial decisions that are not based on assumptions which may not be true in a decade ahead? How do we promote the benefits of homeownership while preparing people for the risks and responsibilities that come with it? So that's on the homeowner. Now let's switch to lenders like ourselves. What are the resets that we need? Here the discussion often becomes centered on the availability of credit, whether banks should simply be lending more. But let's take a step back. By being overly aggressive, the entire housing system caused a great deal of damage to the very people we were trying to help with home ownership. And that damage was certainly not caused because we weren't lending enough. In fact, we were lending too much. The U.S. mortgage crisis originated with a dramatic expansion of credit. Lenders, prompted by lower interest rates, rapidly rising home prices, large amounts of investment capital, made credit available to borrowers who previously would not have qualified, or at levels they would not have qualified, and that ultimately proved to be unsustainable. Subprime loans, little no down payment, stated doc loans, all the things we now know a lot about, expanded dramatically. At Bank of America, our primary window on this was through our acquisition of Countrywide. We had exited subprime lending in our company's history in 2001. In fact, we were criticized by some for not being in subprime lending, and that was fine with us. We did so and still met our longstanding commitment to make loans for low- and moderate-income buyers. At the same time, we did not participate in subprime. There's no doubt that post-crisis credit is tighter, but there's also no doubt that a fundamental part of the lender reset has been reinstituting high-quality underwriting, eliminating specifically designed programs that no longer apply. But if you think about what the industry has been through and what our country has been through and what our customers have been through, there could be no margin for error as we look ahead. We have to make sure that the asset that we originate, the loan that we originate, is ironclad. Now, that's not bad. It just takes a lot more time than it used to. But credit is available. We've expended more than $53 billion in mortgage lending this year to nearly 215,000 borrowers. 30% of these loans have been made to low and moderate income borrowers. The industry has originated about $1.3 trillion so far this year. Access and availability to credit are critical, and lenders have reset along tighter standards. There are opportunities that may exist for some more flexibility. But we can't go back to where we started. We can't go back to where we were. Do we believe home ownership is a good to be pursued at all costs? If we don't believe that, and I don't think any of us do, then strong underwriting and quality credit standards are best protections against putting people in homes that they can't afford. and that's good for both lenders and for borrowers. There's been a lot of debate about down payments. There's a lot of debate going on for various groups about how big they should be, should they be, et cetera. When we think about that, a 20% down payment is light years from what was going on before. But think about the implications of that. I have a 21-year-old child. Think about how much for a $100,000 home to save $20,000 in after-tax proceeds from his income, how long it will take him to save that. That is an implication. So is there any magic to 20% down payment? I'm not sure there is. Is 10% more reasonable? Maybe. It can't go back to zero because then that doesn't work, and we've known that. So a down payment incents all the positive traits of home ownership, saving, delayed gratification of having worked hard for something, plus some security that you have some equity in home if you're hit with an unforeseen event. But there are also very real concerns, and we agree with those, that too high a standard can lock people out of home ownership, something we clearly don't want as an industry and as a country. All the right voices are engaged to ensure we land somewhere reasonable that promotes a more sustainable system and protects the homeowner. So these are questions we need to think about for lenders. First, how do we make credit available but protect people from taking on too much credit and ending up in a home they can't afford? Second, how do we strike the right balance between prudent underwriting, responsible down payments, and access to home ownership? Then we move to the third participant that I talked about earlier, the government. What are the resets for our government? In this area, discussion often becomes dominated by the GSE reform and the stated need by many to wind down Fannie and Freddie. But let's take a step back. Why isn't government involved in the housing market in the first place? There are two core reasons that we believe the government's been involved. First, to expand liquidity, provide active capital. And second, to make home ownership more accessible to those who might otherwise be unable to obtain it. But currently, our government role looks very different. The government dominates the entire housing finance market, as many know, backing about 9 of 10 loans. FHA has been instrumental in sustaining the market for the past few years, but they've come a long way from their traditional role that they played. Their original focus was low and moderate income borrowers in the wake of the Depression and NGIs returning from World War II. Today, they account for 20% of the market and provide low down payment lending for loans up to $729,000. This is just an example where we potentially need a reset of our time. Fannie and Freddie continue to help maintain liquidity in the market in the wake of the housing crisis and the uncertainty surrounding the market in today's real world. But we do need to move to a plan from a market dominated by the GSEs and by FHA and other government sources to one that does three things. First, we need to return FHA and back to its core purpose of helping low to moderate income buyers. Second, the GSEs need to undertake an orderly transition to facilitate the return of private capital, and that they provide clarity to a market about what credit and servicing risks they are willing to take. Third, we need the private capital to come back in the market. We can do that by removing some of the uncertainties about the rules, which hopefully will take place over the next year as we work forward with the remediation of the crisis. I don't think changing any of this abruptly is wise policy. It'll take time to work through all this. We can't eliminate Fannie and Freddie or in a role in the market without having something to absorb it. So the markets are only going to come back in on the private side when there's asset prices are certain, which we're starting to see, and if there are guarantees of liquidity for certain investors. So all these players are critical to transition. The healthy market needs private capital so the government and the taxpayer doesn't take the risk. Clearly, we need that. And that market should come back in a way focused on a value exchange between the borrower, lender, and investor, where everyone understands the deal they're making. And that's what got lost as we ran up to the housing crisis, and that's what we need to restore. So we have a lot of rules that are going on with a lot of names for different things, QM, QRM, Basel III, and many other names and many other rules. It's our ultimate goal to get this settled as a participant in the market and get clarity, and then we can get the market reset. There's been a lot of great dialogue around these attributes, and I'm optimistic that the final rule will strike a balance between consumer protection and access to credit. But we always have to be careful with all these policy inputs into the system to make sure we work on this in a holistic way. What we don't want to end up with is unintended consequences. The phrase, be careful what you wish for, often comes into my mind when I think about all these rules and the changes going on. We can't have private capital closed out, and we can't have government dependency on the future of the housing market finance continue. So these are the questions we need to consider in a reset of the government's role. How do we provide a place for government financing that stays true to the mission of liquidity and access to credit? How do we incent the return of private capital to foster more competition, to shoulder the risk that right now that now falls squarely on American taxpayers and should not? So let me conclude, and then we'll take some questions from Karen and you. There have been a lot of recriminations of the past few years, and we believe it's time to reset, to move past some recriminations and move forward towards solutions, the chance to put the lessons learned to good use, put our housing finance system on a more sustainable path. It's a chance to question and challenge the truths of the old paradigms and reestablish them as we go forward, to reshape our finance system to provide clarity and understanding of risk. It's now our duty to provide a path of homeownership that once achieved what it always meant to be, a place to live, a place that is a reward for hard work and sacrifice, a place to put down roots, a place to have a family. Now is our chance to bring that American dream home, and it's time to reset and do that. Thank you, and I'll, Karen.
So I want to start by thanking you. You raised a lot of themes that we were really hoping to cover as we at Brookings were putting together this event. And I think the questions that you raised about government policy in the last section really set us up for the panel discussion that we're going to have in a few minutes. Let me start where you started with the foreclosure crisis. You said the bank is currently working on 900,000 delinquent loans. So I was wondering if at this case, the easiest cases have been worked out such that going forward, you aren't going to be able to find arrangements that keep as many folks in their homes. And as a follow-up, you know, what kinds of solutions are you offering for homeowners in cases where the mortgage doesn't appear to be sustainable, even with a generous modification?
So on the first issue, remember we talked about at Bank of America how we had 1.6 million seriously delinquent mortgage loans at the peak, and now we're down to 930,000, I think, at 2012. But remember, it's not the same people. So you've had all the new entrants to delinquency have been going through. So in the pool of loans we have today, there are people who became delinquent 60 days or more last month and then months before that. So we're not through the programs. We still modify 30, 40,000 mortgages a quarter, 20,000 short sales. So the amount that's going through is, for lack of a better term, new dialogue, and so new consumers and that to the process. So the overall levels are coming down, but the actual people in the process at any given moment are new to the process. Mm-hmm. So there's plenty of relief left for people. When you talk about the programs going forward, all the programs continue to go on, and you see the principal reduction programs and the national mortgage settlement, which were offered to a stated group of customers. We've made that offer, and we'll finish that up. But the modifications, payments, and things are programs that will continue on past that.
Sure. Do you have a sense of how long it's going to take ultimately?
Well, as we look out, the rate of reduction is about 100,000, 75 to 100,000 a quarter. So if you sort of think about the level that we'll end up based on a portfolio of our size, might be a couple hundred thousand. And so we got to go from 9 down. And as you look across the next, two years, you'll probably see that return more to normal.
Yeah. I know you suggested that we have no shortage of programs to try to tackle these problems. And I presume you were partly referring to government programs. Is there anything else you think the government can be doing to get us through the foreclosure crisis?
Well, I think that the number one thing is to get people divorce the foreclosure crisis from the economics. The reason why people can pay the mortgage loans is generally they're underemployed, unemployed, or a two-income household lost earning power. They're all people get sick and other things happen which are tragic. That has been a constant, that's gone on and shows up over time. It's the unique thing is the amount of people unemployed. So I think the number one thing is to get people back to work. And the good news about that on the housing start side if you're seeing a meaningful pickup in housing construction, which is one of the most stubborn places to get Americans back to work, and that's good news. Now, we've got to be careful not to overshoot again, and I can get in great debate with some of our developer clients about what that level should be, but let's just assume that we've still got room to go before we get there. So I think that's the number one thing. We've got to get people back to work. I think the programs are there. You know, the investors have come along. We still need more participation by more investor groups, and that will provide more fuel. But what really, if the economy continues to improve, and we see the economy continue to improve, 1-2%-ish, you're absorbing jobs, creating jobs, enough jobs, and things are getting better. And that's why you're seeing housing prices stabilize. And so are there pockets that are very difficult still? Yeah, but in the overall thing, it's getting better. So I think really, honestly, it's time now. And Americans aren't patient. And we'd all like this to be behind us and something else to be here. But the reality is, with time, this is working through. And it's been, but unfortunately, it's been 6 years since housing prices quit going up. And we're impatient as a society. And that's because we're a creative and an entrepreneurial society. But I think with time, this will cure. And so I'm not sure fixing it or more programs helps. I think just getting through the ones we have would help it faster.
Yeah, it doesn't, as someone who has to make policy recommendations, counseling patients as a policy solution is always a tough one. Doesn't sell well. I sympathize with that.
Yeah, well, it is not consistent with the urge to fix things. But I think, seriously, if you watch the day-to-day progress, we have come over the top and are coming down, and we are representative of the industry. This will get done, yeah. And the key is just to do it right for the consumer, in an empathetic, clear way. But adding more to it actually lengthens the process at this point.
Can I turn to a somewhat different topic, which is credit availability? So you made it clear in the speech that we can't go back to the kind of go-go days of lending that we saw in the middle of the last decade. I completely agree with that. But speaking of things overshooting, we saw, kind of the credit availability pendulum swing too far in the other direction during the financial crisis. And subsequently, we've seen credit availability get better for some types of loans as the economy has gotten better. But my sense is, and this is looking at kind of the national data, we haven't really seen that much improvement in credit availability when it comes to mortgages for home purchase. And that's at least for the nation as a whole. So I was wondering, is that true for the bank? And, if so, can you help us understand why?
Well, there's no question that if you think about the mortgage market of kind of having a constant level, what got put on top of that was a lot of activity, which is gone and should be gone. And so there always was a large portion of the mortgage market went through a very standard, so to speak, underwriting process, and then you had new programs sprung up to speed up the pace of mortgages and ease in refinancing. And so that's why you had the annual turn, if you take the percentage of mortgages that were refunded in a year, you had reached 30-40%. And that was because these programs. It's come back down to really low, about 13%. Should probably be in a 15-20% type of range, so it's a little lower. But the programs are there, and I think the process is slow. But if you think about it from the perspective of the lending community, we made mortgage loans in 2004 that people said, make a mortgage loan and I want it. In 2012, they're saying, I didn't want it. And you're saying, wait a second, I can't take the risk that you're going to say I don't want it later. So these things are going to be buttoned up, and we quality control the process 3 times. And our error rate is very low. And because we have to protect the integrity of the asset for periods of time, which are way beyond anybody's imagination based on other people's views of what went wrong 10 years down the road looking backwards. So I don't think this is going to change, honestly, but it's not inherently a bad thing. And so then the question is money available in low and moderate programs? As I said, we still do about 20-some percent of originations in those programs. Is money available in FHA? Has made programs available for first-time home buyers with low down payments? We've got to be careful about how much you can do with that. But the programs are there. But the standard, oddly enough, the biggest impact at customers, probably the more standard underwriting customer, has gone from a very simple process to a complex process because we can't differentiate for higher credit quality, honestly. Mm-hmm. And that's the frustrating part of the American consumer. And by the way, it's frustrating to me because we can't get our loans closed fast enough for our customers. And we've added 5,000 people on a base of maybe 15 over the last 12, 18 months into our mortgage origination process to increase our ability to do mortgages, and we're still not doing as well we should. So it's really underwriting applied to the more traditional mortgage, and I'm not sure it's time to pull back on that yet.
Yeah. Well, so just picking up on that last thought, so I understand the reasons for that. I suspect this is, you know, credit availability is part of what's behind the weak household formation that you mentioned, although I completely agree that, you know, the underlying economic conditions, high joblessness is certainly a major force there. But do you see this as kind of a new normal, or is this something that's going to change as the economy, you know, gets better?
Sure. Well, one of the things I think that, one of your colleagues and I had a conversation a while back is and you and your team is led on this, is to almost go city by city, geography by geography, and look at population trends and look at the prospects for population trends and then think about housing policy and that connect. I think that's the right answer, because this is not an aggregate America question. It is a very different question. We're in all, I just had for the last couple of days, all our market presence in from 140 markets around America, and Dallas doesn't know what Detroit's talking about. You know, they really don't. I mean, the population's going, the impact, or Houston, the impacts. I mean, it's just not in their thought process to think that they have a problem with unemployment or housing. Detroit, Columbus, other places have it. You know, parts of Massachusetts have it. Other parts of Massachusetts don't. Parts of New York have it. Other parts. And so I think this has got to be very localized and figure out how you solve the question specifically. So I think availability of credit is fine. I think it's going to be tight more until we get the rules figured out. And then I think you'll bring in the private capital. That'll help. But you know, I'm not sure that's altogether a bad thing, but I think as we plan the policy going forward, I think we got a lot more granular by city to figure out what the right answer should be, as opposed to trying to, or by community or by state or by something, to figure out what the answer should be.
Can you turn now to the customer relationship and how it's changing in responses to the very dramatic developments in the bank environment over the last several years? So first of all, I was delighted to hear about your efforts regarding homebuyer education. You know, it's a huge lesson from the past few years that people need to understand what they're getting into when they make this enormous right. commitment. But let me ask you about a different change in the customer relationship. Or at least a different potential change. It was reported a couple of weeks ago in one news article that I saw that the bank was backing off of a plan to impose new fees on checking accounts under certain circumstances. And so I'm just curious, was the report right, and what should we make of it?
I'm not sure I read it, so but let me tell you what we do, because it's important. So if you think about we think of our general retail business, which is a big business in America. We have about 30 million checking account holders. So we have a big business. And so starting a number of years ago, 2009, I think it was, we started looking at the combination of the economy and people's behaviors and the new devices and everything really changed things. So we started thinking about that. And we figured out that we had to figure out a different way to relate, especially to Americans or median income earners and less, as the way to provide services that was fair to them and fair to our shareholders, and that requires changing the thought process. And so we dropped the overdraft fees, for example, on debit cards in 2009, way ahead of every industry. We went to more transparency. We have lowered that. And we've been managing that dialogue, trying to figure out the right way to handle it. Now, then entered the smartphone, which changes this dynamic dramatically, because now you have a device that's ubiquitous and usable and available for low cost and stuff. And so we're seeing that as an interesting thing. And we're seeing customer behavior change as an interesting thing. So we're trying to develop programs that help people have great access to banking service that Bank of America provides, 5,400 branches, 17,000 ATMs, et cetera, at the same time to do it in a way that we can afford to provide great service to them with the realities of how much revenue there's available, especially in this interest rate environment. So we started redesigning programs, and we kept doing that. So there's a lot of talk about what we're doing or not doing. If I can tell you what we're doing is we have a great transaction platform for the core America. We have kept the prices down. We've lowered the fee aspects, the sort of penalty fee aspects. And what we're looking for is what is the model that will serve those customers going forward. And what we're seeing is 70,000 new mobile banking customers a week. So think about that. 500,000 checks get deposited by people taking pictures of them now, and we only introduce the product in August. And so the behavior is changing so fast that I think 20 million texts that go out to our customers every month saying your balance is low, make sure you don't overdraft. And all that put together is a tremendous level to serve customers who traditionally, with branches and ATMs and things like that, it was a higher cost. Now you can lower the cost. Therefore, you can provide better services, and you don't have to charge the penalty fees. And that's what we're working on.
Great. We have time now for a few questions from the audience. So I could just ask you to first of all, state who you are and who you're with, and then also if you could just keep your question concise so that we can get to as many questions as possible. So with that, I think I have someone walking around with microphones. Is that right? Oh, yeah. So why don't we just take this question right here in the first row.
My name is Alejandro Becerra. I'm with the National Associations of Hispanic Real Estate Professional. You indicated in your presentation or implied that a big part of the foreclosure problem was that many borrowers could not afford the loans they obtained. According to the Wall Street Journal, at the peak of the housing boom, as many as 60% or more of the borrowers actually qualified for prime loans, that is, loans that they could have afforded. Part of my question is, what are we going to do to prevent that from occurring? Last year, according to the Census Bureau, there was a net increase of about 200,000 new owner-occupied households, 80% of which went to Hispanic homeowners and other minorities. At the same time, there was a net decrease of thousands of units, hundreds of thousands of units, for other population groups, including whites. What are the implications to the Bank of America of these demographic changes and developments?
Well, we have, for at least a decade and maybe more, had a we look at our customers, and we're customer-driven. We reflect the customers. So think about us in Los Angeles or Chicago or Houston. And so as the customer demographics change, our ability to provide services change. So we have branches, 10 languages are spoken. We have alternative counseling in multiple languages to help people. So I think from adopting to the population of America and what it looks like, we've been a leader in trying to continue to adopt ways to make the dialogue of our customers more native to them, for lack of a better term, and that's difficult. I think when you go to housing, the groups that you represent are obviously fast-growing in the household population, so the 500,000 households will have a higher percentage of the Hispanic community, which is great. I mean, it's the population of America. That's what makes America terrific, and so serving them, I don't think, is that different than serving in a four decades ago, a different group of population was growing fast, so we just need to serve them well. I think when you get into the debate about foreclosures and stuff now is one that it's just really multifaceted. There's many things about that, which is without a decision point, without that coming to, you can't get the dialogue going about what to do to resolve things. We have many, many events where we invite thousands of customers, about 3% show up, because there isn't a decision point. So it doesn't always end up in foreclosure, but the decision that something has to happen ends up with restructuring a loan and modification. So this thing's wild. But the reality is we only have about 20,000 properties that were actually in OREO status at any given month. And by the way, they almost roll over. So the issue is we have 900,000 people. There is some stage of uncertainty around this, and only a small part. And when we get those properties, they're sold. So how to reposition those houses, that 900,000 is really a tough challenge, and that's what we've been working on. So we work with all kinds of community groups around the country. We've been trying to enlist them to help us, because the comfort that you give your constituencies helps us have a real dialogue about what is the issues, what do we need to work through, how do we get through it. And we need everybody's help here, because the borrowers have to trust the process and the system. So there's, and so I don't know if that answers all your questions, but that's kind of how we think about it.
Okay. Okay. Let's go to the back. So if I could take, the Hamlet's up with the brown suit on, the brown sports jacket on. Yeah.
Hi, Brian. Karen. Barry Zegas with Consumer Federation of America. First, thanks for your thoughtful overview on the housing market. Very helpful. I wanted to ask, on the point about what is the right market share for government-insured mortgages, if you look at the data on Fannie and Freddie's share of securities, right, mortgage-backed securities, it's pretty much within the historical range going all the way back to 1990, number one. Number two, FHA has been the huge expansion. And three, there's virtually no securities activity outside of the footprint of the GSE, so in the private sector that they don't influence. So given those facts, what would you say is the right percentage of the market that FHA and the GSEs, in whatever form they emerge, should play in the market? What's that right balance if they're currently, at least in the GSEs, pretty much where they've been since 1990?
There's a philosophical question. If you could get private capital to do it all, wouldn't you want to have private capital and have the government capital applied to some other issue that we need to solve in America, infrastructure, pick it. So conceptually, you'd like it. Now, the practical reality is if you think about the mortgage debt outstanding, $10, $11 trillion or something like that, mortgage debt outstanding, I think it's 10.5 or something like that, pick a number like that, and you think about all the deposits in the financial services system, it's about that number, slightly less. So you cannot finance this through the banks. And by the way, the nature of the asset is such that banks can't hold it very easily. But then you have the investment community in the U.S. behind it, and you have about 10 or 15% foreign ownership percentage of the GSEs. So I think in the near term, there's no practical solution other than to continue to participate in the governments, because the reality is that with uncertainty about home values, uncertainty about the process, uncertainty about what the asset, for lack of a better term, is, do you think people who don't know America, or outside America, can actually invest? And we need their liquidity to provide the financing, the balance sheet, for lack of a better term. So, but I think long term, the private label market will be there. We shouldn't equate what went wrong with the private label market around the CDOs and things like that. It had nothing to do with the private label securities market. It had to do with the restructuring of and financial engineering around those things. But the actual underlying pass-through notes and things like that have been going on for, 30 years almost now since the SMEA and stuff like that are there. They're true. The investors want them, both U.S. and others, and I think you can get there. That will require higher down payment sustainability and more sort of, for lack of a better term, tried and true underwriting. And so the question in my mind is, I think you need to bring the government down. I think you need to bring the private label up from the current level 9 to 10 down dramatically. I think will it go away? Maybe, but I think that's a decade or two transition, not a 5-year transition, because the amount of investment capital to sustain the level of debt in housing in America is not going to come without liquidity and guarantee. And so I don't want to say a certain percentage, because people then will imply and try to draw a line and get there, but clearly, the goal should be the least amount of support you need for the goal you want. And I think the goal is different now with a more stable population growth in the United States, in an economy that needs to diversify a bit away from us, depending on housing for growth, which was going on in the mid-2000s. You kind of got it where you want it, so let's let it ease out. And I think they should come down to a very small amount. The question is how and when.
I know you need to run to a different meeting, so I'm just going to take the last question as a follow-up, which is just, I see your point that, an abrupt change right now in the housing finance system would be a bad thing, given how fragile the economic recovery is right now. But, is it hard for you? We're not even really kind of talking about what the new system's going to be looking at. It doesn't mean we have to go to the new system right now, but we're not even kind of putting the framework out there. Is that a problem for you guys? Does it make it harder to do your business to kind of devise the strategy that you have for lending?
Well, I'd separate that into a couple things. I think if we can get with the CPFB, with the Director Cordray and others, and the QRM, QM, just the basics, if you look at all these things, everybody's had their sort of perfect answer, and it's a whole bunch of things. If we can get that rationalized to a series of things that you're done with, that provides a stability. I think, to Barry's point, you will start to see an ability to form private market capital coming back in. So I think that's the near-term problem. Longer term, Secretary Geithner put out a proposal 12 months ago, 18 months ago. There has been proposals. I think it's lost behind fiscal cliff and all the other issues at the moment, and should be, honestly. But I think, but the near-term need is to sort of finish the discussion around the core aspects of Dodd-Frank and the other rules and get that done. When you get that done and have that balanced and have a viewpoint, then I think it is time to have the discussion. But a lot of the discussion has to be how you accomplish the transition more than it is the endpoint. Frankly, a lot of debate around the endpoints, variations on a narrow scheme of the government being basically an insurer of way out tail risk for a reasonable price, and the private market's coming in and people can have a definition of that. That's kind of, it's a little bit like every other debate. The answer is not that different from various constituents. The question is between here and there, how do you make the transition? So I think near term we need clarity on these relatively straightforward set of topics. It's not a straightforward set of outcomes. And then longer term, you need to come up with a policy. I think it's a 3-4 year discussion to get it right. You potentially 13, 14, 15, and then you start to implement it. But you're going to have to give lots of warning to America, lots of warning to the markets to do this right, because you can't change this overnight. because you don't want confidence to go backwards because of this, even though your change may be less of an implication. So even the debate around mortgage interest deduction, if you change that overnight and people aren't expecting it, the outcome may be far more serious than the actual outcome of the change. We don't know. But part of it's just to let this thing ease into the psychology of the American buyer and let people adjust their viewpoints.
I think this sets us up nicely for the panel that comes because I think they're going to be grappling with a lot of these issues about what the new system is going to look at. Before you leave, I just want to say to folks that Brian is going to leave, and then we are going to have the panelists kind of hop up on stage just in about 60 seconds. So if we could just get you to kind of stay in your seats while that happens, that would be terrific. But then, of course, before we even do that, I just want to thank you, Brian. I know you have an incredibly busy schedule, and we really appreciate you coming here to spend some time with us and tell us about what's going on with the bank.
Sure. I appreciate you sponsoring this discussion, there's nothing more important for America to get this right over time, and thank you for your participation.
Perfect. Thank you.
Welcome on behalf of all the panelists here. I just want to thank the Brookings Institution for having us here and to discuss what I believe at least is one of the most important issues in the economy going forward. I'm Diana Olick from CNBC. I cover real estate. That's all I do, and that's mostly what all of these panelists talk about. We're going to give them each a chance to do a short presentation before I ask some questions, and then we'll give the audience a chance to ask some questions as well. So we're going to start with this side, Douglas Holtz-Eakin.
Thank you. Thanks for the chance to be here today. You know, the topic is what's the future for home ownership, and there are really two answers to that. What will be the future and what should be the future? In terms of what will be the future, I want to echo something that Brian Moynihan emphasized, which is the pace of economic growth in the United States. I think that's fundamental to the degree to which we quickly recover in housing markets across the country. I've been to a variety of different markets for events to sort of look at this: Sacramento, Las Vegas, Phoenix, Orlando, Columbus, and the nature of the recoveries differs greatly, but the pattern that emerges is one in which the broader-based economies recover better than those which are narrow, and the importance of economic growth just cannot be overstated. The second one, which doesn't get talked about as much, but which I think is very important, is the future of U.S. immigration policy, which is central to so many things and is one of the underserved policy topics in the United States. The native-born population of the U.S. doesn't have replacement fertility rates. So all future population growth depends on what we choose for immigration. And given the importance of demographics to housing markets, this is the issue over the longer term. And so those two things strike me as central to how it will play out. In terms of the things that we ought to do, it seems to me that we have a couple of things. The first is to recognize that it is time to look forward. You know, this crisis began years ago now, and I was once in the camp of designing very clever policies. I promise you, they were very clever. Solve all these problems. But you know, more policy innovation, more new programs, more interventions, I think is now beginning to make it too difficult to figure out what the rules are and to move forward. It's time to let markets clear, move forward as fast as we can. That's point number one. Point number two is to recognize that we are determining the future of housing policy right now, whether we know it or not. And the example I'd point out is the QMQRM and the Basel III Accords and their implementation. Some work I've done with some others at the American Action Forum suggests that if you look at the credit implications of those rules versus normal lending, say, circa 2001, take the bubble years out of it, we are on track to provide financing for about 20% fewer mortgages than we would have had we had the standards of 2001. We ought to decide whether we want that or not, because it's happening right now as we go forward. And then in terms of the final things, which are the big ones, like, you know, what are we going to do? The central focus needs to be on providing shelter for Americans and to have a clear objective of having those who are in need of shelter have opportunities to have it, whether it's own versus rent. We shouldn't have a big stake in that. On the home ownership side, I believe there are two things that politically will end up being true. Number one, Americans will not give up their deep love of the 30-year fixed-rate mortgage. Maybe second behind children, but they love it very, very much. And that will require a government backstop. And the design of that government backstop is going to be very important. We know that the GSE model is broken, and we have to come up with something different. We can come back and probably talk about that. And the second and open question will be whether there has to be a front-end subsidy of the type that's been the mortgage interest deduction. And it may turn out that that's true, particularly in a weak economy and housing market. And if so, I would simply implore our policymakers to not subsidize in an open-ended fashion. Our federal government is not in the position to provide open-ended subsidies for anything anymore, and in particular not to reward those who become heavily indebted. Let's have something that rewards equity investment in a comparable fashion. And so I think that's briefly the lay of the land, both now and for the years to come.
Janice, both of you.
Thanks. So my name's Janice Bowdler. I oversee economic policy at the National Council of La Raza, which, for those of you that aren't familiar, is the nation's largest Hispanic civil rights organization. So in my brief opening comments, I just want to make three quick points. One is that demographics in this country are changing, and that has huge implications for our housing policy, but also our service and our programs in this space. My second point is that those borrowers don't just look different. They're not just different ages. They have dramatically different credit profiles than what we've seen in earlier generations. And then my third point is that we really know how to do sustainable homeownership right. We just haven't focused a lot of time and attention into bringing that to scale. So let me quickly touch on each of these three issues. The demographics issue already came up. Thank you, my friend Alejandro, here in the front during Q&A. But let me put a fine point on this. According to recent research, 70% of household growth over the next few decades is going to be driven by households of color. And by 2020, half of all first-time home buyers will be Latino. That is significant. Right now, babies born in this country are born into a cohort where no one ethnicity dominates. So we are seeing a dramatic shift in our population. That means that as housers, we need to think about what do those communities need, both on the rental side and the homeownership side. And if our systems can't accommodate that, then we're going to end up with lopsided policy once again. On the profiles, again, very different profiles. We have to think about meeting these households where they're at. We've just been through a recession that has hit communities of color particularly hard. Latino families have seen double-digit unemployment for a couple of years now. You couple that with foreclosures and the decline in wealth, and in fact, Latino families lost two-thirds of their wealth due to decline in home values or outright home loss. That is an extremely different profile, thinking about what they're going to need when they re-enter the market looking for a home. but not just families who had it tough. If we think about where our students are, we don't always talk about student debt in our housing conversations, but we should. I saw a Business Week report that student loan debt is going up $3,000 a second. These are our future home buyers. They are over leveraged already, and it coming into an economy where wages are flat. So what their credit profiles look like, again, are going to be extremely different. And we can make a choice when it comes to housing policy. Do we just shrink the market, or do we think creatively about how to make sure that these kinds of borrowers that have very different profiles can be accommodated? So that really brings me to my last point, which is sustainable homeownership. For so long, over the last couple of years, our conversations around housing policy have really been dominated by the responsible borrower. Please note my heavy use of quotes there. We talk about making sure that only responsible borrowers are able to get a loan modification or get a mortgage. But in fact, we're asking the wrong question. First of all, that question implies that the run-up to the crisis and everything that went wrong, we can debate the causes and consequences later and probably till we're blue in the face. But it really implies a very simplistic answer to the crisis, that somehow bad decision making on the part of millions of borrowers brought us here. That ignores the systemic issues that we were dealing with and makes that a much more simplistic answer than what we know was a very complex situation. The right question for us to be asking is, how do we take those models of sustainable homeownership and get them to scale so that we can build the most inclusive market possible, so that all of these families that I'm talking about that are about to burst onto our homeownership stage, our homeownership markets, are able to get a loan? And I agree. It's not necessary. We're not talking about fancy, new, sort of wildly creative things here. We're talking about 30-year fixed-rate mortgages with housing counseling and good servicing. It's a pretty simple recipe, but we've seen that it works. As we look at the future of homeownership, I really want to impress on all of you and our policymakers that it only behooves us to grow the pie. That's going to be incredibly important for our economic growth. And let me end just by picking up on one thing that you said, Doug. As we think about our immigration policy, we also need to think domestically what's going on with the immigration debate, which we know is going to be a major policy conversation in 2013. If we see 11 million people in this country earn a path to citizenship, that's also going to have serious implications as housers, thinking about the household formation that's going to come out of that, a major shift for our country. And so we need to be thinking about that as well.
Great. Tom? He's got slides.
Tom's fancy.
It's Tom Deutsch, I'm the Executive Director of the American Securitization Forum. We're a trade association for all the folks in the secondary market for mortgage-backed and other asset-backed securities, both credit cards, auto loans, student loans, et cetera. So I'm going to provide a little bit of context to a lot of the discussion of, you know, where were we in terms of credit availability, where was the money coming from, where was it going to. So just to provide a little bit of a backdrop of where a lot of capital comes outside of the banking sector, if you think about, you know, so the old view of mortgage lending, the kind of it's a wonderful life, you go down to your local bank, get a loan, and you always deal with the local banker, those days have been long gone for decades now, if you really think about it, because at this stage, most of the credit availability in the United States doesn't come through the banking sector. You may get a loan from a bank, say Bank of America, but the capital from that doesn't come out of Bank of America's pocket. Right now, most of that is coming out of Fannie and Freddie or FHA. But historically, that has fluctuated quite significantly, whether that's coming from government markets or coming from, you know, purely private sector. So this provides a little bit of a backdrop of global securitization issuance around the world, obviously the U.S. being a heavy user of credit products. Europe being, you know, a distant second, and then other parts of the world. But it gives you a little bit of a backdrop of, you know, a huge amount of credit availability, sort of a wash of credit availability in 05 to 07, big drop off in 08 and 09, and then some very, very slow you know, increases. This gives you some backdrop that the securitization markets in the United States have have come back to an extent. If you look at the various asset classes, auto loans, there's just not as many auto loans being made right now as there were, say, 5 years ago, not as many people buying cars. But generally, the market's functioning. It's working. Student loans, not nearly as many student loans going to the private sector since the shift in the FFELP program. Most of those loans now are going directly under the government's balance sheet. Credit card, there are accounting changes through FAS 166 and 167 that have fundamentally changed that credit card ABS market. Equipments are different. Collateralized loan obligations are actually, this data is a little bit old from 2011 and 2012. There were about $50 billion in CLOs that were originated, so that market is rapidly returning, and then dealer floor plan deals. This is, I think, the slide that everybody talks about in various formats is the dramatic change in how mortgage credit is made in the United States over the past 6 years. This is the only slide I can possibly show you in the entire world where securitization volumes have actually gone up, and that is the agency MBS market have gone up precipitously by $300 billion in the last 6 years. So you've got a huge change where the private MBS, effectively private credit, private investors without a government guarantee, it was a huge volume, too large of a volume in 2006 with $700 billion being put through the private label mortgage-backed security system. But now that has shrunk to, and I think $22 billion is really overstating it. A lot of that is sort of re-remix and repackaging and not really true new loan originations that are going through the securitization system. But of all the slides that I have, I think this is the most telling of where is the credit coming from? And basically, it's coming through the U.S. government balance sheet, through Fannie, Freddie, and FHA. Lots of statistics about 90 to 95% of loans being made in America right now are being effectively guaranteed by the government. But to put this in a little bit of international context, there's a lot of RMBS that's originated around the world as well. It's not just a U.S. phenomenon. Europe uses the technology quite significantly and doesn't use a government backing program. They do use a covered bond system as well that has some, you can argue, some various backings through the banking sector. But ultimately, you have a significant amount of private label RMBS originated throughout the world. But the one key thing about Europe is that much of their securities that they issue, they actually retain on their own balance sheet. They keep as securities, and then they pledge them to the European Central Bank. So it's a way of getting credit through the government system. It's not Fannie and Freddie-like, but it still has a big government backdrop here over the past couple of years. Japan, Australia, each of these will show you a little bit that RMBS is a big part of their securitization markets and where the private credit is coming from. But that gets you back to where is the U.S. now? One of the key challenges is if you want to go to a laboratory and think what's the optimal mortgage system, the problem is you can't do that. You have an outstanding mortgage stock in the United States, and you have some outstanding issues. So delinquencies, defaults, and some of these, some of this data is a little bit dated from earlier in 2012. But it gives you some snapshots of where the delinquencies are, the significant negative equity problem in the United States, where something like a quarter of the residential properties in the United States have some form of underwater nature to the mortgage. So there's still some challenges clearly outstanding in the market. But the key is, where do you get new credit from? Where is the credit going to come back into the system outside of the Fannie Freddie model? And there's lots of calls. You hear it from both sides of the political aisle. You hear it from Barney Frank. You hear it from Jeb Hensarling, you know, the former chair of the House Financial Services Committee, the new incoming chair of the House Financial Services Committee. They both agree Fannie, Freddie, FHA have to be drawn back somehow and in some way. How you do that? Well, that could be a decade-long question that we're going to be continuing to answer at a political level. But this provides at least some of the basic high points of where is it that this private capital is going to come from? How does it return? And one of the key questions is, if you're a pension fund, let's say, and you've got to put your pensioner money back to work, do you put that money into the U.S. housing stock market? Do you effectively, through the securitization market, lend that to borrowers? One of the key challenges, if you're, a pension fund manager, is do you want to loan money to people at 3, 3.5, 4% to buy a house? Many of the pension funds' answers is no. That's just simply not enough return. The federal government may be doing that through FHA or through Fannie or Freddie, but the private markets are saying that's just simply not enough return to put our money there. We're going to put it somewhere else, whether that's, you know, French muni bonds or, you know, some sort of Japanese capital markets products. the liquidity of the capital markets moves pretty quickly. So when you start seeing the housing market rebound, you'll start seeing the private capital come back in because there's less danger. There's less risk of home price depreciation, which obviously creates some more delinquencies and defaults, which then in turn creates more risk, you know, for the money that you put back into the securities market. So it's just a quick overshot of the securities market and where this capital can come back. If you think about the 2006 volume, $720 billion, that's out of the system now. How do you bring some of that back? Do we want $700 billion in private capital? No. But do we want $200 billion, $300 billion? I don't know what the number is, but it's definitely not zero. So anyway, let me turn it back to Diane.
So thanks very much. I'm Ellen Seidman, and I want to build on some of the things that others have said here already. I want to add first, before I really go into my major point, a couple of additional points about why we ought to not settle for 10% less than 2001 level mortgage market. We really do run the risk of basing future policy on a very strange last 8 years, and we shouldn't be doing that. So leaving aside all of the aspirational issues and issues that Janice has discussed, if we don't keep the housing market ladder robust, in other words, if we don't keep people coming in at the bottom, it becomes very, very difficult for people to move up. It becomes very, very difficult for us baby boomers to move out. And that has very significant effects on the economy. And just to give you a couple of numbers, the boomers are going to release somewhere between 10.5 and 11.5 million homes, 80% of them owner-occupied single-family homes in the next 10 years. And the question is, who's going to buy those homes? And if we don't have a system that enables the people Janice and others have been talking about to buy those homes, it's going to be a very difficult transition. It's different in different locations. And I think that one of the interesting implications of some of the conversation that we've had today is, for years, we've talked about the importance, and this was a critical element in during the Depression when Fannie and Freddie, well, Fannie was created and then subsequently Freddie, the notion of having a housing market that was the same all across the country. And now we're very much recognizing that we've got different markets, and we've got different markets now, and we've got different markets coming in the future. What does that actually mean for our housing policy? And I think it's a huge question. But what I actually want to talk about is rental, because home ownership can't stand on its own. I believe that one of the reasons we ended up with a push into home ownership, let me just say before I say this, that in my the crazy boom of the early 2000s was heavily, heavily, heavily a refi boom. And it was heavily a move-up boom. It was not a first-time homebuyer boom. Nevertheless, there was a huge push to first-time homebuyer, in part because we were doing rentals so badly. And it's time to recognize that and to fix it. Over a third of the American households are renters. There were a million renting households added just in 2011. This is an even greater percentage at the lower end, and we have a real mess. Vacancy rates declined from 8% at the end of 2009 to 4.7% as of the second quarter of 2012. The number of low-income renters has grown over the last decade by over 2 million, but we've lost 12% of the low-rent housing units. The subsidized units, we've lost 350,000 between 2000 and 2010, we're due to potentially lose another 900,000. We need to fix this problem as well as the homeownership problem, and they are two parts of the same coin, in part because almost everybody rents before they own, and many people rent after they own. And we owe it to the entire economy as well as to the individuals to fix this. So I've got 4 points. We just have to fix the simple availability of lower rent, especially larger size units, in places that are choice neighborhoods to live in with jobs. We have to stop the continuing loss of affordable rental units to conversion, obsolescence, and demolition. We have to figure out, and this is going to probably take some government backing, how to have consistent financing for non-luxury and smaller buildings, which, frankly, is where a huge percentage of the affordable stock is. And finally, I think we need to be thinking about some non-fee alternatives, the stuff between rental and ownership, so that you can have shelter and some appreciation, but you don't necessarily have to take on the full load.
Thanks. Brian, a few times mentioned the phrase resetting policy. So just as a little context on how hard this might be, we've got a long bipartisan tradition of promoting home ownership at the policy level. Just quickly on, Google is a powerful thing. You can find speeches at least dating back to President Hoover that are virtually indistinguishable from each other on the importance of promoting home ownership. The only way you can distinguish in a blind test is before the 90s, a home was a man's place that we needed to support, and then after the 90s, it was a family's place we needed to support, apparently. But just a few, and it was also very obviously bipartisan, to pull a few quotes, President Clinton said, "When we boost the number of homeowners in our country, we strengthen our economy and we build better citizens." And President Bush said, "Homeownership is the cornerstone of America's vibrant communities and benefits individual families by building stability and long-term financial security." So I think it's fairly obvious over the past few years that some of these statements, I think, are overstated. Just on the simple evidence of the importance of homeownership and in President Bush's words, long-term financial security, our homeownership rate peaked in the middle of last decade, which was not a harbinger of long-term financial security. If you look simply across countries, some countries such as Canada has similar homeownership rates that we do, but doesn't subsidize it as heavily. Other countries like Germany and Switzerland have much lower homeownership rates, where Spain, for example, has a much higher homeownership rate. So in simple correlations, it's if anything, it's not a key ingredient or necessary ingredient for a strong economy, contrary to what the last almost 100 years of presidential speeches would suggest. I'm going to reiterate what Doug said. The issue here is not whether or not we should be subsidizing shelter. It's how we should apportion our subsidies between homeownership and rentership. And right now, it's disproportionately towards homeownership by about 4-1 in current policy. I'm going to focus, people have been talking about mortgage finance. I want to just focus a little bit on the tax side because that's the biggest source of subsidies for homeownership. In 2011, the mortgage interest deduction amounted to about $80 billion a year of tax revenue, lost tax revenue. The deductibility of property taxes was about $25 billion, and the exclusion of capital gains on the sale of primary residences was about $20 billion. So that's a significant amount of revenue, and if you look at the projections, it'd be increasing depending on, we can't go an hour without saying fiscal cliff, but depending on how the fiscal cliff negotiations go. But it is a significant amount of revenue, especially as Doug alluded to, in a very constrained fiscal world that we face right now. So there's definitely scope and need for rethinking the distribution of our net subsidies across home ownership and renting. The usual case, if you're going to justify that much intervention towards homeownership, I'm by trade an economist, so you would look for market failure justifications for it. And indeed, there are some in the literature. And in fact, Brian alluded to a few of them. There is some evidence that homeownership increases tenure, it increases civic engagement, and it therefore increases investment in local public goods. I would offer three cautionary counterpoints to this. One, these estimates by the authors, frequently by their own admission, are highly uncertain. It's very difficult to know whether or not homeownership is leading to these positive outcomes, or people who seek greater tenure and seek greater civic engagement tend to be homeowners. So it's a very, empirically, it's a difficult thing to even know. Secondly, even if it's empirically valid, it does cut both ways, and this was alluded to before. Greater tenure might make you more civically engaged in your local community. It also might make you less mobile, which could also lead to labor market inefficiencies, and there's some evidence of that as well. those empirical evidence suffer from the same problem as the counter studies, but it's just to say that it does cut both ways. And third, I would suggest that even if we think that we should be leaning into homeownership over rentership, we're not going about it the right way. We have very clunky policy, as Doug alluded to also, on the mortgage interest deduction. It's in addition to subsidizing home ownership, it also is subsidizing lower down payments, more borrowing, bigger homes, more energy use. So there are better ways to do it. I don't think we're going to get rid of the mortgage interest deduction, but there are a lot of plans on the table on how to revise it, I think, in strategic and smart ways and to limit it. So I'll just conclude by that by saying we indeed should be subsidizing shelter across rentership and home ownership, but I think both the theory and the empirical evidence suggests that we're too disproportionately focused on one rather than the other.
Thank you. We're going to do some questions now, and I would just urge the panel so we can get as many questions in as possible to keep the answers tight. But going back to what we talked about on subsidies, and especially since we are talking about the future of home ownership, I want to get back to this point. If you take financial security, as you said, out of the equation in home ownership, and you look at how many people are getting into a home as an investment versus as just simply a place to live, which historically is where we were supposed to, then you begin to talk about subsidies. And I want to go back to what Doug was saying. And my question to you is, when you talk about getting rid of subsidies for home ownership, do you believe that the Fed's purchases of mortgage-backed securities, which have pushed interest rates down to historic lows, are a subsidy, and B, a subsidy that should continue or should go away?
Well, I think on net they are a subsidy. I mean, I don't think that's the main goal. The goal was to have a channel to expand economic activity in the United States. I would argue it's been minimally successful, and the sooner they can exit their extraordinary monetary stance, the better, both for the Fed as an institution, because it's very hard to do, and it will signal success on two other fronts. It will mean that we're growing and they're exiting, and I think that's going to happen as soon as the fiscal side gets its house in order. And so they'll get out of this as fast as Congress and the administration put the fiscal house in order. Let us take a moment to pray.
And if we're moving away from home ownership subsidies, should there be more? We talk about renter nation, that we've moved with this attitude away from home ownership that we saw as were quoted by two last presidents, and that now the attitude of the newer generations is renting makes it more affordable, more mobile, less risk involved, and if you're not, again, going to see the kind of home equity appreciation that we've seen, which we'll never see again, then why bother? The question now is, do we need to see rental subsidies? And I'd like to put that back to Ellen. What kind of subsidies or what kind of help would you like to see in the rental market other than just new construction?
So, first of all, let me just say that if you take a look at the numbers, the mortgage interest deduction will cost the Treasury about $131 billion in 2012, which is more than all of the HUD outlays by, 2.5 times. HUD outlays were $48 billion. So, you know, one point here is that we just need to equalize some of the stuff we're doing already. A second point is, and I know I'm going to get pushback on this from Doug, but the only part of the whole sort of panoply of programs that actually is producing rental housing for lower-income families these days is the low-income housing tax credit.
Oh, you're
credit.
So wrong.
And it's producing it not just for new construction. In fact, new construction is down. It's producing it heavily in terms of rehab and renovation, which is also really important because an awful lot of that stuff is in markets where if the use restrictions are allowed to expire, it will be lost for low-income families. I think another piece that we got lost in all of the concern about, legitimate concern, about investor owners of small properties is that the 1-to-4 family buildings that have a lot of rental units in them were always financed as single-family homes. It's very hard to get financing for that kind of housing now, and an awful lot of it really does need to be rehabilitated or refinanced. And we need to figure out, as we're rebuilding our financing system, how we can effectively finance those small buildings. And it's not just the 1 to 4s, it's sort of the up to 50s. And that's not subsidy, but it's paying attention to how the financing system affects rental, and rental that's not luxury rental.
Now, moving into the new population of homeowners that are coming in, and as you, mm-hmm. Janice, points out, it's going to be largely Hispanic. During the housing boom, as we know, Hispanics, blacks were targeted by mortgage lenders, and in some cases, terribly fraudulently targeted, as we've seen in lawsuits, many, many lawsuits. Do you believe that the safeguards put in place by the CFPB and by federal regulators are sufficient going forward in the mortgage lending market to serve the population that's coming in?
I think Dodd-Frank did a great job at really taking care of a lot of the retail abuses that we saw. And so I think we'll see on that side a better market going forward. But the other side of that coin that we haven't quite figured out is how to make sure that good products are available. So it's one thing to take the bad products out of the market, but we still need to make sure that there's enough liquidity available to make good products available, that there's enough incentive out there in the market for those good lenders to go out and affirmatively market and locate in the neighborhoods where communities of color are. I mean, we can talk all day about predatory lending, but the fact of the matter is that predatory lenders moved in to fill a vacuum where good lenders weren't serving. And so we took care of some of the predatory stuff. We need to make sure that our housing finance system going forward makes good products accessible.
And let me just say that we talked a little bit about counseling also. And counseling is really, really critical, but for years, in fact, it has been almost entirely, and Bank of America and other lenders do support it to some extent, but it's been almost entirely supported by a combination of the government and philanthropy. Mm-hmm. You know, the lenders and investors benefit from it also, and we need to figure out how to get a much more balanced system because the system has to be a lot bigger.
I hate to say this, but we're already getting the wrap to take questions from the audience, so I'm going to do that because you all went over your time. there's the microphone. Okay. Want to just take this gentleman right here?
Which one?
Right there, raising his hand.
Thank you. Larry Checo, Checo Communications. I was intrigued by Mr. Moynihan's presentation because he kind of made it the responsibility of everybody else and not the financial institutions. This crisis did not have to happen. There were too many people incentivized the wrong way. Financial institutions lost their moral compass, and nobody had any skin in the game. And I think I appreciate Brookings looking towards the future, but if we don't go back to the past and try to rectify some of this, it's going to happen again, because it seems every 10 or 15 years our financial institutions put us in this kind of a bind. And I would like people to address what the financial institutions can do to rectify the future. In other words, have skin in the game. Everybody was selling these things off, and it was like musical chairs.
Yeah, I mean, I can take a couple parts of that. I mean, first, there is, I guess, massive regulatory change in the wake of the crisis. So you talk about Dodd-Frank. Within the next 30 days, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau is going to be putting out two major, I would call them, you know, landmark pieces of regulation. Quote-unquote, qualified mortgage, which is really the core of it, is does the borrower have an ability to repay the mortgage? That's the simplest question that the CFPB has been grappling with for 2 years of how do you measure that? Because you can put in a very simple metric like a debt-to-income ratio. So if you take 43% of your income and apply that towards your debts, that's an appropriate top end of the ability to repay, and there's some rumors that may end up somehow into the rule. The question is, the challenge with borrowers is that they all don't look alike. They all have all kinds of varying characteristics. So some may have very good debt-to-income ratios. They may be 25%, but they may have all kinds of other factors that may make them not as good of a credit. Or they may have, let's say it's a retiree, they may have a debt-to-income ratio at 100%. They don't make any money, but they've got savings and they're a good credit. Should you be able to lend to them? So there's a challenge there of trying to create a rule that's sort of a one-size-fits-all. How do you measure an ability to repay? And you do that objectively. I think the capital markets, to bring back $700 billion or $300 billion a year, whatever that number it is, the people who invest that money, they want to know we've clearly made what is a qualified mortgage, because we don't want to take the litigation risks and the like of having those loans put back to us if it turns out not to be.
And can I make a...
have a stake in it? Shouldn't they, everybody hold a portion of that loan for a while? Because the thing that got it all crazy was that people were just selling these loans and nobody had a stake in it. I didn't care if this young lady could pay the loan back, because I was selling it to somebody.
And that's part of the second regulation, which is QRM, which is also coming out. And you wanted to add?
Well, I was just going to, your other question about what can banks do, and referencing Mr. Moynihan's comments. And he mentioned this. I actually wish he would have spent a little bit more time on it. And that is that the Bank of America has made a commitment to do principal correction on the most amount of portfolio that they can. So they can't do principal reduction on loans owned by Fannie and Freddie. That's a whole other panel that I would love to participate on in the future. but for those loans that they can, they're taking a hard look. And I hope I don't get this wrong. I thought I heard him say that his average was about $150,000, which is significant. That's much more than we're seeing other banks do. And that commitment to do as much as they can on their own portfolio is more than other banks are doing, and they deserve credit for that. We've got 11 million homeowners that are underwater, and several economists have come out and said that that is a major drag on our economy for a number of reasons.
Can I just say something?
I just want to get at least one more question.
The privilege of serving on the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission spent 18 months on this, and I would urge no one to adopt simplistic explanations of what went on. It wasn't just banks. There are non-bank entities involved, and it wasn't just financial institutions. It took a lot of factors to produce the perfect storm, and I encourage you to read my dissent as opposed to the majority opinion.
Two-part question. One is, the organizations that are working on behalf of your constituents, what are the conversations that you're having with the banking industry and local and state governments in creating an environment with regard to affordable housing? And number two, why are we looking at places like Japan with regard to multifamily units that are eco-energy efficient and in the long term very, very affordable?
Either of you like to take
it? Jen, well, on the eco-friendly multifamily units. In fact, they're to the extent that we're doing new multifamily construction at the lower end, there actually has been a movement towards much greener building and a recognition that if you can keep the operating costs down, you have made an enormous dent in the affordability. In terms of interest of governments in affordable housing, I think there, in fact, at the state and local level, continues to be huge interest. One very big problem is that the places that have been hardest hit by the housing problem have also been hardest hit in their pocketbooks. And these are the places where they're having trouble paying the police and fire. Firefighters, as well as taking care of huge quantities of vacant buildings.
I think we have time for one more question, sir. Been patient.
It seems that there are many forms of government stimulus for the housing bubble that we've had in the past and might have again in the future. The speaker on the end there talked a lot about the government subsidies in form of taxes, mortgage deduction, property tax deduction. The fiscal cliff gives an opportunity. I've heard some, but not enough discussion of an intermediate solution by supporting home ownership, keeping the deduction for your first home, not your second, not the one you're speculating to flip on and all that. That would seem a very easy solution in this time of crisis, to eliminate the tax subsidies for the home buying beyond the family first family home.
Sure. Yeah, there are such proposals. There were the two deficit reduction commissions over the last few years proposed roughly similar reforms to mortgage interest deduction. For one, capping it instead of $1 million of principal interest on $1 million of principal, capping it at $500,000, which gets kind of more at the marginal decision of promoting homeownership than at the inframarginal decision of promoting a bigger mortgage. So it's kind of limiting the size of the mortgage, and also shifting it distributionally from a deduction to a credit. And in that, again, besides saving revenue, it probably cuts it in half as much on the tax revenue side. It also shifts it on the distribution to the lower end of the income distribution. Right now, if the mortgage interest deduction doesn't help you if you're not an itemizer, and it doesn't help you that much if you're in the lower tax brackets even. And so by shifting it to a refundable credit, as they suggested, you kind of shift it down. And make it more less regressive. So there are out there, I think Doug alluded to this, whether or not such a thing passes is going to be extremely politically challenging. I think any attempt will be a little bit less sophisticated. It might be just a across-the-board limit on deductions, which has been proposed in various different flavors, which would have similar effects, but not quite the same.
I'm afraid that's all the time we have, but I'd like to thank all of the panelists, and Brookings especially, for having us.